Hi, everybody. My name is George. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me. It's really a privilege to be here. I was here for your anniversary meeting, and you guys have such a great group here. There are pockets of enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous all over, and this is definitely one. And I'm really feel honored to have been asked to be here tonight, and I'd like to thank my sweetheart, Trenton, also one of my favorite speakers, for coming out here with me tonight and for the sweet life we have today. And Betsy, thank you for your 10 minutes. That was really great. 10 minutes is the worst time frame, and you did really well with it. That was so good. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I got sober when I was 24, which makes me way older than I thought I'd ever be. That would be 56 for those of you who are math impaired like myself. It's funny, my dad, when I was six, my dad died of cancer, and he was 54. And throughout my teens and my 20s, when people would say, "Oh man, I'm sorry your dad died, that's really sad," I'd say, "Oh, but he lived a really long life." And now I'm that age, I'm like, what? I don't feel like I've lived a really long life. But I definitely, the sober years have been the best. You know, I can divide my life into the two sections. There's before I got sober, I made every decision based on my feelings. What a mess that was. And for the last almost 32 years, I've made decisions based on what the next right action is with the help of a sponsor and all the tools of this program. And boy, what a difference it's been. I have a big, beautiful life today. And one of the main reasons is because I do things I don't want to do every single day. Because all I really want to do is lay in bed and watch reruns of Law and Order and Sex and the City. And but part of my third step practice is when I'm asked to do something, whether I want to do it or not, if my calendar's open, I say yes. And as a result, I've been able to do a bunch of stuff that I would have never done otherwise. My sponsor today is Marilyn S., and she always says, "Just say yes to the universe." And that's been, you know, I'm like, no. Whatever. Can I ask you a question? No. Do you want it? No. Can you? No. That's always what I'm thinking, but I've learned just to say yes. Anyway, I don't remember my first drink. I hear people talk about that first drink. I took a drink, it went boom, I went on, everything changed. That was not my experience. I started drinking out of the adult drinks as a little girl, and as my dad was getting sick, I was left alone a lot, and with adults that would let me drink out of their drinks, and my dad used to let me drink his beer and tomato juice or whatever he was drinking. So I kind of tapered on. After my dad died, my mom worked three jobs to keep a roof over our head, and so I was alone a lot. I've never been grounded. I've never had any rules. And so I just got thirsty. I always had really big emotions. So when I say I made decisions based on how I felt, I mean, what a train wreck, because my feelings were so huge. I feel like I was born singing the blues, like big, big, big emotions. And that was always such a liability for me until I got sober and was able to kind of process through all that, through the steps, and now that is my superpower. All those big feelings I have, I get to use for the good. But back then I was using it for self, and oh, what a mess. But anyway, so I started drinking just a little bit here and there, and then I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood. I was really lonely. I always looked older than I was. I always felt older than I was. I was not relating to people my age who were playing with Barbies and playing games and making mud pies and stuff. Like, I had serious stuff going on at my house. I felt like an adult. I liked hanging out with the adults, and so I started hanging out with the older kids, and they were smoking and they were drinking, so that's what I was doing. I started stealing my mom's car, well, my dad's car that was left parked in the driveway after he died. Our house kind of looked like Sanford and Sons, and if you don't know what that show is, you can Google it, but it's a junkyard. And so that was one of the cars in our yard, and I started stealing that when I was 10 and smoking, and I had a 16-year-old boyfriend when I was 10, which just makes me do this. But at the time, it seemed normal. You know, I couldn't articulate it back then, but I just had the sense that if I could just find someone to love me, I'd be okay. I always wanted to be part of a family. You know, all my friends seemed to have curfews and sit down to eat dinner at the same time every day, and they went on family trips, and they had Christmas trees at Christmas, and you know, they did all the things that I would see the families on TV do, because TV is really how I was raised. Television raised me, which explains so much. But I just always felt so lonely, and I started hanging out with the older kids, smoking, drinking, and it took off right away. And I don't think the things that happened to me as a kid made me an alcoholic. I believe I was born that way, but I do believe that the things that happened made me thirstier younger, and because I didn't have any rules, my alcoholism was able to blossom a lot earlier. And so by the time I was 11, I was arrested for drinking in public, and by the time I was 12, I had my first suicide attempt. By the time I was 12 years old, I look at kids that age, and I just, the older I get, the sadder it makes me that I was that out of answers at 12 years old, that I had already, like, given up dreaming that anything could ever be any better, that I hated myself that much that was the only thing I could think of. I just wanted to check out. I just couldn't bear the pain anymore. And by the time I was 13, I ended up pregnant and terminated that pregnancy because my mom and my boyfriend insisted that I do it, and I agreed because I need them to love me, so I'll be okay. But I will agree to things, and then I'll punish you. So I resented them and hated them and drank over that for a long, long time. And it wasn't until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard that we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And that's finally when I was able to get some relief, is when I shared those things I swore I'd never tell another human being. It's been a really big part of my sobriety, as I came here with all these things that I swore I would never tell you, because I just knew that it would make you not love me. But that's what's always kept the separateness in between me and you, is those secrets. And it's me telling you those things that I swore I'd never tell another human being that got rid of that separateness that I felt. But I didn't know that back then. So I had so many secrets and so much shame. And like I said, my emotions were so big. And I think my mom, I know now, I didn't find out many years into sobriety what kind of childhood she had. But I think I illustrated, you know, my emotions were big. I don't hide them. I was acting out how she felt, and she couldn't bear it because she's had to stuff down her feelings for so long. And I was just there as a constant reminder of her lack of tools, her pain, you know. And so if you've ever been in a space with someone and you know they don't like you. Now, they haven't said that, but you just know. That's how I felt in my house. I felt like I knew my mom loved me. There was always food in the fridge. She was always at the house. She didn't have a life except going to work and sitting in front of the TV. TV's a big part of my story. But I always had that sense that she just couldn't stand me. And I think it was because I was so much like her. And her sadness and her anger was so, like, it would take your breath away if you were in the room with her. Like, you could just, like, it would envelop you or envelop me. But I didn't understand why it was there, but I assumed all of her resentments. I assumed, you know, like, doctors, oh, they're bad, and that neighbor, and I had all these resentments that I had no experience to back them up. But anyway, so that was kind of my home life. Mom's working all the time. I'm out. You know, I'm student body president in sixth grade, and by seventh grade, I started dropping out because I could not drink. I would go to school, hook up with some friends, bring them back to my place, because my mom by that time had said, if you're going to drink, if you're going to smoke, I'd rather you do it at home. I'd rather you not be out there getting into trouble. So I would pack all of your kids into my room, ditch school, and I might be waking up from my first blackout when my mom's coming home from working in a school cafeteria, getting ready to go clean a different person's house every day of the week. And I'm just getting up, getting ready to go party some more. And we were poor, so I stole a lot. I stole clothes, I stole booze, I stole stuff from my mom. I always justified it because if you felt the way I felt, if you lacked what I lacked, you would have to do this too. I'm just trying to survive, you know. And had a second suicide attempt at 13, and I had one right before I got sober, and I had to have my stomach pumped. And so all those years, you know, just hating myself so much made it that much more important that you love me. So that thing where I just need someone to love me so I'd be okay became my only focus. I never dreamed of doing or being anything but loved. I never thought, oh, I'll go to college one day and become a doctor or a lawyer. I never felt a calling to serve my country. You know, it was like, find someone to love you and then you'll be okay. And all the TV shows and all the movies I saw backed up that idea. And it wasn't until I had double-digit sobriety that I learned that a man is not a plan. But but for many, many decades, that was the only plan on file, you know. I went through all sorts of different phases with different kinds of drugs because they were available when I was a teenager. And but I could always stop because alcohol was there. So what ended up happening is my mom claimed bankruptcy when I graduated from high school, which I just barely graduated. But as soon as she knew I was graduating, she's like, quit all three jobs, moved up north to live with my grandma. And my mom and my grandma were my only family. My grandma was the meanest human being I'd ever met. She was a nasty drunk. She used to say, you know, your grandma's not an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk. And I don't even know why she was telling me that back then. I didn't even know what the words meant. I didn't know that those two words were the same thing. So not an alcoholic drunk, okay, noted. But I found out later that she was the town drunk. But she was always more or less drunk when I was around her. And after my dad died, we never went on any family trips. The only place we ever went was to my grandma's tiny little house that was about 300 miles away. And we'd be cooped up in this house. I hated being there, hated leaving my friends. But at least my mom and grandma drank, so I could drink there. But my grandma would tell me how I ruined my mom's life and how crappy I was and selfish I was. And, you know, if I didn't want to eat what they wanted to eat, it was because I was selfish. And my hair was stringy and how I dressed. And you're too fat, you're too thin. You know, it was just constant. And then she told me that she, too, would be dying soon. And how would I feel when she dies? Because I'm such a terrible person. And honestly, not too bad, I don't think. But but I did not want her to die. Obviously, I'm not a monster or anything, but I found out later that she started telling my mom that she was dying when my mom was 9, and my grandma had her when she was 18. So my grandma died from the age of 27 until she actually died at 90. There was never a time when she wasn't telling me that she was dying. You know, your family's not going to be around for too much longer. I'm like, ugh. But anyway, so my grandma would tell me if my dad were alive how disappointed he'd be in me, and my mom was sad and mad and all of those things because of me, and the truth was is that I believe that was the truth. And so when she pointed that out, I had to build a case against her. I had to hate her. I had to hate my mom because it was just too much to bear that. And anyway, so when I graduated high school, my mom moved up with my grandma. I'm like, cool, Cuckoo Town is all contained. I don't have to deal with them anymore. And now I can live the way I've always wanted to live, which I'd always done. I'd always lived pretty selfishly, but I ended up getting a great job right out of high school. But what happens is I build up my life and things get going okay for a few months, maybe. It feels like a really long time, but it's usually a few months. And then my drinking brings everything crashing down. And I alienate the people that care about me. I embarrass myself, and I got to go. And so there's a lot of moving of relationships, a lot of overlapping, meaning I can't leave one until the next one's lined up. And so there's a lot of, yeah. So there's that going on. There's difficulty in getting to work on time, being consistent, all of that kind of stuff. And my world was getting smaller and smaller because no matter how much I promise you, no matter how much I promise me, no matter how much I love you, no matter how much you love me, once I pick up that first drink, I have no choice. I'm going to get drunk no matter what. That's what's happening. I could not see that. In fact, I had been to a couple of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with friends who really needed it because I'm a good friend. And I remember some old guy, probably my age now, saying, you know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I remember thinking, what a bunch of lightweights. Not really. But then I was able to see this firsthand after this experience I'm about to tell you about. So I'm trying to keep it together, but, you know, my life is getting messier and messier and smaller, and I'm lying and I'm cheating, so, you know, I'm losing a lot of friends, and I'm just really alone. And I had that last suicide attempt that I talked to you about, that I had to have my stomach pumped, and I felt so old and so tired, And my roommate had a brother who had a little problem with crack cocaine, and he moved in with us, and so I was introduced to that fine substance. And within 6 months of doing that, I lost everything. I was evicted from where I lived, fired from my job, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20. And so when I had no place to go, it was my best friend's parents who took me in. Obviously, I had a problem with drugs, so I could admit that, but I still couldn't see that it was alcoholism. It's always been alcoholism since the beginning. So this was sort of my chapter three. You know, I'm going to drink, but when I drink, I'm not going to wake up with a stranger. I'm not going to drive people drunk. I'm not going to go clean out my account. You know, all these things I'm not going to do. And then I would go do those things. I'm like, what's happening? You know, how is this happening? And that last year of my drinking was some of the most darkest and depraved, drinking alone, meeting people, doing things, and waking up in the morning just sick all the time. And I got to the point where I thought, oh, I can't drink either. What am I going to do? I can't go to AA because now I've got the crack thing. I can't go there. And plus all the God stuff. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion. If there's a God, I really don't care for his work so far. So that's not going to work for me. And so I thought, well, how hard can it be? I just won't drink. And it was really hard. I couldn't go a day. And then I thought, well, it seems like my people are destined to be miserable. So if I'm going to be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. And I was living, like I said, with my best friend's parents. And I had a room in their basement. And I decided that I was going to drink and not feel bad about it anymore. So I went to pour myself a drink. It was White Zin in the box. And I poured that. And just then the phone rang. And it was a guy by the name of Jeff Monahan. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd been a sober member of the Pacific Group in Los Angeles, had moved to San Diego, and happened to work at the same company as my normie friend, Diana, whose parents I was living with. And so she began confiding in him about her loser friend living with her parents. And so he offered to call me, and he called me, and he said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And for whatever reason, I told this stranger, yes, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, my husband Vince and I are going to a meeting. Why don't you come with us? And for whatever reason, I drove to their house, and I went to that meeting. And it always blows me away that a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. When I think about like what God's grace is, it's that. Because I qualified for this program as early as, you know, 11. I was already drinking with problems. There was never a time I drank without problems. It was a problem from the beginning. So Pat and Vince took me to the big Wednesday night meeting, the Pacific Group, and it was more like this meeting than the other meetings I'd been to. Really seemed like a bummer, but also I realized it was my perception too, but people were happy and sober at the same time. I always thought it was or. You're happy or sober. I didn't know you could be both. And Pat said the magic words. She said, I'll be your sponsor until you find one. And I was so done. I was so done. I was so desperate. Thank God. Like, I was out of ideas. I tried everything. And so I was willing to listen to her. And at first, I kept hearing about 30, 60, 90 days. And I thought, I'll try this for 30 days. But in our home group, we talk a lot about getting a first-year foundation. And this is one of the great things about being a member of a home group, is that everybody's doing the same thing. Everybody's saying the same thing. So you can just jump in. And no matter who you talk to, you're going to get the same answer, which I really love. And so I had tried it my way for about 14 years. So I thought, I'm going to try this first-year foundation thing. I know it won't work for me because my life is so tragic and I'm so different, but I'm going to try it. And so that made me willing. So when Pat started asking me to do things that I thought were insane, I would say yes, almost to prove that it wasn't going to work for me because I'm so tragic. And so she wanted me to go to regular meetings on regular days. And she told me to get commitments at those meetings. And she told me to call her every day. Like, what am I going to say to her? She's got 17 years sober at that time. Like, she doesn't even remember what it's like to drink. And so really awkward. But I started doing that, and I started feeling better right away because I've never had any structure in my life. I always thought structure was the man trying to keep you down. People over 30 who don't understand freedom. But the truth is that I've never had structure in my life. I've never gone to school on a regular basis, work on a regular basis. I've never been faithful in a relationship. I've never eaten a meal on a regular basis. Like, I had no structure. So by having just this little bit of structure, calling Pat every day, going to the same meetings every week, having a commitment, It was like, the more structure I had, I could exhale. It was like, the more structure I had, the more creative I felt. The more structure I had, the calmer I felt. The more structure I had, it was like, the more I did, the more I could do. It didn't work on paper, but somehow it was working. And so I began to thrive on that. And I was about 2 weeks sober, and a family friend came forward and told me all these secrets that my mom and grandma had kept from me. And I always knew that there was something weird about their relationship. They seemed to not really like each other, but need to be together and be... like, my mom was fiercely loyal to my grandma, and I always thought, why? She's awful to you, and you hate her, and you guys hate each other. And when they were together, they'd be like, your mother, your grandmother. I'd be like, mm. And so they were always, there was always stuff going on, and sometimes they talked in a secret language, and they weird stuff. I don't know. So, like I said, I really dig the detective stories, so I fancy myself a bit of a detective. So I'd been through all of their personal belongings over the years, trying to uncover what the secret was, because I knew I could find some kind of secret that would explain why I was so screwed up. And I had never been able to find anything, because they're good hiders, as it turns out. But so flash forward, I'm 2 weeks sober, and this family friend says, I know some stuff I think you should know. And I was like, I knew it, which is my favorite thing to say. And so he told me all of these things that my mom had lied to me about, and I'm like, oh. So I wrote everything down, because my goal, or my plan, was to take the secrets to her and tell her what I really thought about her, because I thought that was integrity. It takes courage. This is not true. Talk to your sponsor. Do not do that. But I wrote down everything he said, and I wanted to make sure I had all the details, because when you hurt me, I like to be super specific when I throw it in your face, and I didn't want to miss a thing. And so I wrote these things down, but instead of calling my mom, I called Pat. And I said, look at what I found out. And she said, it's so good you have that written down. You're going to need that later. But for now, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter. Like, that is insane. Did you not hear what I said? Although that was my inside voice. But I don't know how to be a good daughter and granddaughter. And so we came up with a plan. And that was that I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. And if I were doing these things, I would know that I'd done everything I could on my side of the street, and maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober. Because where my mom and grandma were concerned, they were my only family. It was just the three of us. I was raised with that. You know, it's just the three of us. The world is a hard, cold, scary place. You can't trust anyone. You're going to have to work one day, and you're going to hate it. Life sucks. Have a drink. You know, like, really dark. And so I felt fierce loyalty, but I also felt guilt and hatred, and I loved them, and embarrassment and shame and blame and all those feelings at the same time. And I don't think I could have stayed sober had I not changed my behavior right away. And so I started doing what Pat asked, sending a card once a week, calling once a week. Super awkward at first, because I don't know what to say. I would only call. I loved calling my mom to tell her really bad things, because I wanted to hurt her. I wanted her to know how badly I was doing. Like, you're a and it's because I'm the way I am because you were a terrible mom. So I would call her, be like, I have no place to live. I've got no money. You know, and then I wouldn't call for months. And so now I'm just calling to be like, hey, so I see it's sunny over there where you are. You know, like, I don't know. I would have some kind of current event on tap. But the more I did it, the easier it became. And so things began to change. And I started writing more in the cards I was sending every week. And then I began to imagine how each of those must arrive. And they must be so happy to get them in the mail. And maybe they put them in a beautiful decorative box. And maybe keep them tied with a lovely ribbon. And maybe even reread them on a cold winter's night. Oh, remember this one? Oh, that Georgie. She's so clever. And I found out that's not what was happening when I made my weekly call to my mom, and she said, well, we've been getting your cards, but Grandma's been having to white them out to reuse them, and we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. And so I did. I wrote those cards in pencil for over a decade, and the reason why is because I now had a sponsor who told me I never have to go through anything alone, and I could take all my problems to her. I was beginning to have an experience of my own higher power. Goosebumps right now. From my head to my feet. I was beginning to have an experience of my own higher power as a result of going through the steps with a sponsor. I had more friends than I dreamed a girl like me could ever have, and I was beginning to learn I had more tools than I ever knew existed. And it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility. And in this case, it was me. I had the most tools. And so I wrote those damned cards in pencil. I wrote a little bit less at first to punish them. Of course, they didn't notice. I remember I was maybe 3 years sober, and I accidentally slipped one through in pen. There may be some therapists in here who say, accident? I think not. But it felt like an accident. And I sent the card, and I made the weekly call to my mom, and my mom said, well, we got your card. It was in pen. And I remember thinking, oh, no, no, no. I was, like, not in a good place right there. But I knew well enough to say, oh, look at the time. I've got to run. And hung up the phone, and I called Marilyn, who's been my sponsor now for the last 30 years. And I said, that's it. I call, I write, I visit, I'm done. And she said, I think you've made a wonderful amends to your mother and grandmother, and you don't owe them anything else. And I said, yes. And she said, however. I think it would be a wonderful spiritual exercise if you continued to do so. And so I did. I wrote those damn cards in pencil. But my relationship with my mom and grandma, like, I thought it would just get rid of some of the guilt that I felt. But what happened was, and I've learned this again and again through different lessons in sobriety, my intentions don't matter. They really don't. It's my actions. And so in sending the cards and then in hearing your stories, I became less afraid of my mom and grandma, less afraid of their pain. And in selecting the cards and writing their address on the card and dotting my I's with little hearts, which I still do now, I know, but whatever. Sending the cards, writing the notes, like I was love, love, love. I was feeling love. And in taking these loving actions toward my mom and grandma, even writing the cards in pencil, which I resented at first, I began to see that as an act of love. What ended up happening is I began loving them. And they may have loved me all along, but, you know, getting is good, getting feels good, but the only thing that fills up that emptiness is my loving you, and it was the actions of my loving them that filled me up. And what a great lesson that was. And also a great lesson in this was that I'm only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on your side of the street, none of my business. The dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. And the exercise here was to be a good daughter and granddaughter, not if I deem them worthy, not if they reciprocate. It was plain to be a good daughter and granddaughter. And so my behavior defines who I am. So I get to choose, and that goes for work, friends, I get to be the best employee that I can be. I get to be the best friend, regardless of what other people are doing on their side of the street. And so anyway, I made it through that first year, went through the steps. I know you guys have watches here, too. I was able to have a watch, which was amazing. The only way you can go to watches is the only way you can have a watch is you have to go to watches so you don't sleep for like a year. You know, school nights at watches, and I lived far away. And anyway, so I was damn well going to have my watch. And there were probably like 200 people there. And I couldn't believe that, and it was on a Tuesday night too, I think. It was a weeknight, I know. I couldn't believe how much my life had changed in just a year. And, you know, a lot has happened over the last 31 and three quarter years I've been sober. And there's so many things that have happened that if you had told me, you know, you'll have to go through these things in sobriety, I would have said, no, thank you very much. May I have another drink? But as it turns out, I have found that God gives us just what we need, just when we need it, and not sometimes not a second before. And so I ended up getting married when I had like a year and a half sober, and I was married my first 5 years of sobriety. And those were great years because we both put AA first. We stayed close to our sponsors, and so when it didn't work out, we didn't have to be unkind to each other. We didn't have to fight over our home group, and, you know, we got to walk through it with grace and dignity, and that is not me. That is not how I end relationships. And by that time in my sobriety, you know, my relationship with my mom and grandma was going better. I had a job that I loved. I had begun to live a very... My life operated at a very high velocity. I went to work. I was taking newcomers to meetings. I was taking meetings to sick people and sick people to doctors and taking classes and just like 7 days a week. Ah! in our group, we do shows for everything. So I've done, like, I don't know, 40 plus musical theater things we do. I was going to the yard on Saturday, you know, just all the stuff that we do. And then I had to have back surgery. I'd had minor back surgery early in sobriety, but I had to have a spinal fusion. And the recovery time was supposed to be about 6 months. But I was in that 1% or whatever where something went wrong, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. And during that year, I lost everything except my sobriety. And it was the guy that I was seeing at that time came to me months into this illness that I was down with for so long and said that he considered a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and he dumped me. And I was so devastated, and I called Marilyn, and at the time she was learning to play guitar, so she'd often be plucking away in the background, which is not a bad way to get direction. But I had told her, you know, okay, so that there was the surgery, complications, can't drive, had to sell my car, couldn't work, had to give up this job that I loved, couldn't pay my bills, best friend, Normie, best friend Diana, to the rescue again. My mom and grandma couldn't be there for me, not for lack of time or vehicles, they just couldn't be there for me. But my home group was, and they were taking me to and from doctor's appointments, but I was just, it felt like I was losing everything, and I had found my value in being of service. It's my loving you that fills me up. It's when I'm lonely, I've got to pick up the phone, I've got to be of service. Now I'm like this, and now I get dumped. So I call Marilyn, and I'm like, and now I got dumped. And she's, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression, and she sang my blues, and it made me laugh. And that's been one of the greatest gifts of my sobriety, is finding humor in everything. And Marilyn, I'm not kidding, she is the funniest person I've ever met, and she finds a great deal of humor in my darkest moments. But I was full, I was so full of uselessness and self-pity at that time. And, you know, we can pray for character defects to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. And at that time, there was a man in our group. His name was Mike Finch. He was 34 years old, and he'd been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And I watched him go from walking and talking and being super active to being paralyzed from his neck down in a wheelchair. And the thing that never changed about him, he was always laughing. He was always with a group of guys he sponsored in his handicap van, going to conferences and ball games. I used to call him the Make-A-Wish boy, which is really distasteful, but he had a good sense of humor. But I watched him, and I'm like, but my disease was, I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is debilitating and painful, but it's not fatal. His disease was fatal, and the way we were dealing with it seemed clearly different. And his wife had also left him when he was sick, and so he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends, and I was able to help take care of him the last 6 months of his life, which I did not know I was capable of. I didn't know I could love someone like that. I'd always measured love in what I was getting. And this was some. This is that time, like, God gave me just what I needed, just when I needed it, because I had no ability to do what I was asked to do those next 6 months. And our life was, it was fun and beautiful and tragic and ridiculously funny, and it was everything, you know. And I've always tried to buffer myself from the bad feelings. I don't want to feel the sad, the scared. I don't want those. I want all the good ones. But what I've come to find out is that all of my feelings are a gift of sobriety. And because Alcoholics Anonymous gives us this beautiful net with God, steps, a sponsorship, all of the tools we have here, I got to love a man that I knew was going to die and it wasn't going to break me, because that beautiful net of AA was there to catch me. And so I got to feel all the feelings. And I always share this because there was a woman in our group, Julie S., and her son died on his senior trip in a car accident. And she'd been grieving for a long time, and well-meaning people will say stupid things. You have to forgive them every day, forever and ever. But anyway, well-meaning people were saying things to her like, maybe you've been grieving too long, maybe you need to get outside help or whatever. And I remember her saying something to the effect of, I want to feel every feeling that had to do with this glorious boy that I loved so much. And that's always stuck with me. Like, she saw that as a gift, even the seemingly bad feelings. And so because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to have all of these really deep, rich healing experiences. That period of time with Mike helped me heal a lot of stuff when my dad was dying. My dad was dying of stomach cancer, and there was a lot of stuff that happened during that time that felt unresolved that I got to resolve with Mike. And I just never knew there would be a solution for that. I thought AA was about not drinking, but it was about a whole new way of life. And about a month before Mike passed away, my grandma died. Now, I don't know what happened, but that mean, wicked woman became a nice grandma. And I think it was in those first few months and couple of years of the cards, the calls, keeping my side of the street clean, not going to the dry well for water, that my grandma started saying things like, well, you know your grandma loves you. I'd be like, oh, no, I didn't. Inside voice, though. But I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and she stayed nice grandma until the end. In fact, I called her my granny goose, and she'd erase my beautiful cards and send them back to me with her note. It was crazy, but I think just as our disease ripples out into the lives of the people we love, so does our recovery. And my mom and grandma's lives were profoundly changed by Alcoholics Anonymous. So when my grandma died, we were good, and I was able to be there to support my mom. And about a month later, Mike passed away, and I was there holding his hand. And it doesn't always happen that way, but in this case, it did. And after Mike passed away, and I was living in San Diego with him, and I moved back to L.A., and it was really hard getting back into my home group and, you know, just being like a newcomer. You know, I felt like I needed an engraved invitation to meetings. It was just hard to crawl. I thought I would be, you know, walking on some high spiritual plane from this experience, but I just got really small. And anyway, my mom asked to see me. I had moved back to L.A., and I drove up to where she lives, and she said, there's some things I need to tell you now that grandma's gone. She said my grandma was a really private person, and out of respect for her, she didn't want to tell me before. So she told me those secrets that I'd written in the book. Now, the secrets I'd written in the book was that my mom and dad had never been married, even though they said they were, that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me, my dad had had an affair with a neighbor, which resulted in a child. So those were the secrets in the book. But what my mom told me that day was a whole lot more. And she never knew that I had that book. I had never found it necessary to throw those in her face, even though that was my goal at the beginning. So she said that at 8 years old, my grandma was sent to live with another family because her parents couldn't take care of both her and her sister. And in that house where my grandma went to live at 8 years old, she never went to another day of school, and she was physically abused and sexually abused in that house. And the way she got out of that is she got pregnant by a man she didn't love and had my mom when she was 18. And by the time my mom was born, my grandma had already left that man and started her own crazy life and started leaving my mom with other families and in boarding schools. And she'd forget her over the summers. And my mom was left there alone in clothes and shoes that didn't fit her, watching other families pick up the other kids. And nobody was picking her up. And she had nobody. And as a teenager, my mom was given the option to go live with my grandma. At last, she's going to go live with her mom, you know? And it turns out that by that time, my grandma had turned to a life of racketeering and prostitution and had started running a brothel out in the middle of the Mojave Desert and turned my mom out at 15 to work that business. And so my mom never went to another day of school and was physically abused and sexually abused. And the story she told me over the next 2 days of that life and what she had to do, and it was horrific. It's like the worst story I've heard inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't believe that it was coming from my mom. I mean, my mom never had any friends. She never dated in the time I knew her. I never imagined what these things happened to her. In fact, she had two kids that she put up for adoption when she was a teenager in that lifestyle, and she was heartbroken about that, and it made sense suddenly, like why she was so insistent that I terminate that pregnancy when I was 13. Right or wrong, our perception is our reality. And in her case, reality was that the world was a cold, hard, scary place, and she knew that reality, and she was trying to spare me. I always thought she was trying to punish me. I thought she wanted to hurt me. And I can see now how all the choices she made was to ensure that I had a better life than her and a better life than my grandma. Thank God I was given that direction to change my behavior before I knew that, to just change my behavior and treat my mom like she was this hero, because it turns out she was able to keep me in the same house until I graduated from high school. She never had that. She was always home. You know, like, I look at things differently now, and I see how I had the life of a princess compared to the life that my mom and grandma had. And I had spent my whole life being mad at my mom for not giving me these things, love and direction. If only I'd had those things, I would have been a different person. I always thought she had these things to give but withheld them from me because she deemed me unworthy in some way. But it turned out she never had them to give. They were things she never possessed. And so another level of freedom. And so I was able to give her all the things that I wanted. And our relationship was healed. And those last few years were with her were the best because we were both free. And she ended up getting diagnosed with lung cancer, and it went to her bones and her brain, and she ended up dying. And I was able to take care of her the last few months of her life. And I've got like a minute. A lot has happened over the years. Next to getting sober, the best thing that's happened to me is working at the Midnight Mission in Skid Row. I started volunteering there when I got sober, and I've been an employee there for the last 15 years, and I get to take all the love and hope I get in these rooms to Skid Row every day, which is a great blessing because this pile of crap has been suddenly transformed to gold. And so I get to use everything I have every day. And in closing, relationships have always been a challenge for me. And I was finally in a place in my life where I'm like, I think maybe I'm just not made for relationships. I was happy being single, really genuinely happy. I have a nice career. I have a great place to live. I was taking dancing lessons and going hearing bands and going to doing what I want to do when I want to do it, shaving my legs, not shaving my legs. And eating popcorn on the couch, watching reruns of Grey's Anatomy. And then my friend Trenton asked me to speak at his conference. And we started talking, and we've been together ever since, and it's been really great. He's one of the best examples of AA that I know, and we have such similar experiences, and so we're really good to each other, and it's been really lovely. And AA is at the center of our life, and I'm just so grateful. Thank you.